This is Jim Hightower with my little pops of populism every single day, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and welcome to Eco Radio KC. My name is Mike Murphy. On tonight's program, Elaine Giesel regales us with everything we need to know about the monarch butterfly, the beauty and wonder of this fantastic multi-generational migration that takes place on our continent every year, as well as the threat to the species and the thought of whether or not it should be added to the endangered species list. But first, I've got a couple of items of news for you. Tom Cullen from StormLake.com in Iowa reports that Ruby Montoya and Jessica Resnicek believe they were helping residents in Buena Vista County, Iowa, for setting over $1 million in pipeline construction equipment ablaze in November. In an interview with the Storm Lake Times on Wednesday, Montoya, 27, and Resnicek, 36, admitted to burning pipeline equipment in northern Buena Vista County last April. Resnicek, a resident of Des Moines and a Dallas County native, said they burned over $1 million of equipment owned by Precision Pipeline of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, with every ounce of love in their hearts. I was born and raised in Dallas County. I love the people of Iowa, Buena Vista County included, Resnicek said over the phone at the tail end of a camping trip in Minnesota. Iowans resisted the pipeline from the beginning. They're tired of seeing our waterways destroyed by the industry. Montoya cited the book of Genesis and Revelations, the first and last books of the Bible, as moral justification for the vandalism. Montoya and Resnicek live at the Des Moines Catholic Worker House. In Genesis, God gave his dominion over the earth. In Revelation, those who destroyed the earth destroyed their souls, Montoya said. From the beginning, it's our duty to be stewards of the earth. I couldn't think of a worse case of poor stewardship than this pipeline. In the women's eyes, the only form of cosmic justice is for the $3.8 billion pipeline to be removed from the ground, and they believe it will be removed soon enough. They believe the earth is so contaminated that divine intervention could come sooner rather than later. Extinction is on the table, Montoya said. We're acting in the 11th hour where there's desecration of God's great earth. Jessica and I acted out of necessity. We removed from our nonviolent protests, we were abused by private thuggish security firms, and local law enforcement was complicit. The women maintained the arsons were another form of nonviolent protest because they were destroying the property that was just desecrating the earth. On Friday, FBI agents raided their home on Indiana Avenue and seized evidence to corroborate the arson, according to the Catholic Worker House's spokesman Frank Cordero. They refused to admit how many arsons they committed or clarify their tactics. We have no comment at this time, Resnicek said. We issued a statement in July, and I'll leave it at that. The statement they read reads that the women started their vandalisms in Buena Vista County and continued to Mahaska County and South Dakota. The women then moved to unsecured valves across the pipeline in Iowa until they ran out of supplies. The women aren't planning any further action to derail the pipeline. We're focusing on the legal system this time. And we'll try and get those folks on the phone on next week's program. We're having Robin Martinez on. Robin Martinez, in addition to being KKFI's attorney, he was an attorney for the Dakota Rural Access. Dakota Rural Action, who were fighting against the Dakota Access Pipeline, And in his capacity with the National Lawyers Guild, he was a volunteer coordinator for getting attorneys to help fight the Keystone XL pipeline. So Robin will join us next week. We may have one or more of these Catholic workers on as well. And then speaking of stewards, a little update to last week's program. We're taking the KCUR is reported that the Flint Hills residents did, in fact, take their fight to the Kansas energy regulators as part of their broader battle to stem wastewater disposal in the area, in the Flint Hills. They fear that a request from Quail Oil and Gas to jettison up to 5,000 barrels a day of brine near Strong City and the Tall Crest Prairie National Preserve brings a risk for earthquakes or contamination of local groundwater, claims that the company disputes. An hours-long hearing in Topeka saw the two sides pit their lawyers and geologists against each other in hopes of winning over the three members of the Kansas Corporation Commission. The commissioners will likely issue their decisions within a couple of months. Fossil fuel companies churn up salt water in the course of oil and gas production and dispose of it in wells by pouring or pumping it downward with pressure. And please check out last week's Eco Radio KC program on at kkfi.org on our podcast. You could also see the link if you go to Eco Radio KC's Facebook page. But tonight we're going to hear from Elaine Giesel about the monarch butterfly. I had the opportunity to record Elaine. I just turned on the mics and let her go, and she spoke most eloquently and without pause, and which is an audio editor's dream. And so we're going to hear from Elaine right after this.
Native and invasive crayfish square off on this current cast. Crayfish are an important part of the food web in streams. But in Pennsylvania, an invasive species called rusty crayfish is taking over. And in some areas, they're so dense, they stack on top of each other. Dave Lieb with the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy says rusty crayfish are bigger and more aggressive. And they'll eat just about anything, including fish eggs, algae, and insects.
When you have an exotic crayfish invasion, many fish populations tend to decline.
Rusty crayfish were introduced by people dumping bait or unwanted pets into waterways. So today, it's against the law in Pennsylvania to move crayfish from one body of water to another. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
The 2017 Crossroads Music Fest on September the 9th will include free day parties sponsored by Josie Records with live music from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Josie Records, 1814 Oak and Brewery Imperial, 1829 Oak. Also new this year, pop-up shops with local makers in the Josie Records parking lot from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. More information is available at cmfkc.com.
For 30 years, KKFI has been supported by listeners just like you. Thank you for being there for us so we can be there for you. To help sustain independent community radio, go to kkfi.org and click donate.
All right, this is Elaine Giesel, and I'm a Kansas Master Naturalist. We'd like to talk today about a phenomenon that happens every year and is, you know, rather than a solar eclipse that happens once in a lifetime. This is something that you can observe every year if you pay attention to what's going on in the world around you. What we're talking about is the migration of the monarch butterfly. A lot of people think they know about the monarch, but there's a lot more to this story than perhaps you are aware. The monarch is one of the most easily recognizable butterflies that moves through our Kansas City area. And in fact, right now, you may be seeing them in your backyard. What's interesting is that this is not the population that is going to be migrating yet. This is the parents, the last generation that's going to be here in the Midwest, and their babies are going to head to Mexico in about a month. It takes about a month to go from egg to caterpillar to pupa and to adult. Now, why do I know these are not the migrators? Because they're laying eggs. And monarchs that are laying eggs, mating, are not the ones ready to migrate. They are still making babies right now, and that's good. It's warm. There are a lot of nectar flowers still available for their babies to drink and fatten up for the long journey. And we're talking about a journey, ultimately, that for some of the monarchs is over 2,000 miles long, because they're doing the same thing, not just in Kansas City right now, but all the way up into Canada. And at some interesting cue, they're going to change the way they live. Instead of living 2 or 3 weeks, which is the normal lifespan of most monarch butterflies, they will live now for 9 months. And they enter what's called diapause. It's a technical term for being on hold. They're not going to reproduce until next year. The internal organs shut down, the reproductive organs, and these guys just fatten up on nectar and begin their journey. And that's the mystery of the monarch migration. How does an insect, 4 to 5 inches across, manage to make a journey of over 2,000 miles in some cases to Mexico over winter and then return to the U.S. and had never been there before? And this is part of that mystery. There are several generations of monarchs that intervene between the ones that went to Mexico and the ones that go to Mexico the next year. And there's no book. There's no map. We have no idea, really, how they find a very small area in the mountains of central Mexico where they overwinter. We don't know entirely why they do it either. So this is as I say, as fascinating a natural phenomenon as a solar eclipse. And it happens every year and sadly is now considered a threatened phenomenon. In fact, there is an official agency globally that has declared that the monarch migration as we know it is threatened. It's not the monarch population itself, because there are actually monarchs not only in the U.S. but in the Caribbean, in Central America, and they have spread into the Pacific Islands, which is also an interesting question, whether they got there by accident, during migration, got blown out into the Pacific Islands, they're in Australia, New Zealand, Hawaii, or were carried there by humans, which is, of course, one of the problems we deal with on this planet now that we have a global economy. Things get moved around the planet that normally would not have done so. But I urge our listeners to get outside and watch a monarch. They are a phenomenal butterfly. And if you are growing milkweed in your backyard, which I hope you'll consider doing, you can help preserve the migration of the monarch for future generations. So let's talk. Well, how does an insect know where it's going if it's several generations removed from the generation that was there before, and where are they going? What's interesting is that some of these questions have just begun to be answered. There was a researcher in Canada who began the process of tagging monarch butterflies in order to determine where they went. He could see them breeding, multiplying in Canada late in the summer, and then they seemed to all get up and go in the same direction, and he had no idea where. And apparently no one else at the time knew either. And he began by putting small paper tags on the front edges of the wings, and the tag said, if you find this butterfly, please contact so-and-so. This was in the 50s. It was not until 1975, which is well into my lifetime, that we actually discovered where this butterfly was going. It's in a very remote part of central Mexico, up in the highlands west of Mexico City, in a particular forest type called the Oyamel Fir Forest. And they were going to an area no one really had knowledge of other than the local people, who apparently were not sharing this knowledge widely. In fact, the story of the individuals who found this area was that it was a very hostile area to outsiders. There were guns. And so people weren't exploring the area on a routine basis. But not to have discovered where these tens of millions, hundreds of millions of butterflies were going is phenomenal in my mind, that it took until 1975, our modern scientific world, to discover this. But it was actually due to the effort of citizen scientists. The individual who started this research recruited through the media hundreds of people to tag monarchs, and they did, tagging hundreds of thousands of them over time. But the odds of being able to recover even a single tag out of the tens of millions of butterflies, you know, are very small. So research proceeded relatively slowly. But over the next 10 to 20 years, they were able to capture enough tag butterflies on their way to Mexico that they knew they were heading south, going through Texas. And initially, it was believed that it was in Texas that they were staying over the winter. Texas is certainly warmer than Canada. But the researcher came to Texas, could not find an area in Texas that they were overwintering, and it was obvious they were heading even further south. And that's kind of where the mystery stopped back in the 60s, mid-60s, early 70s. Eventually, as I said, a couple working in Mexico actually did find this location in the Oyamel Forest and were astounded that these hundreds of millions of butterflies were draped on the trees, body next to body, so that the fir trees look golden brown in color. That color, by the way, is how they determine how many butterflies there are today. Aerial photos are taken, and they are analyzed, remote sensing, so to speak, and using the color of the butterfly against the trees, the green trees, they measure the acreage that these butterflies are using for overwintering. And what prompted a great deal of work right now on the monarch migration is that since the 1990s, there has been a steady decline in the acreage. They don't count the butterflies. That would be physically impossible. They measure the acreage, and they have seen an 80% decline in the area that these butterflies use. Now, they return every year to this same little pocket of mountains, volcanic mountains in Mexico. So they fly over the area. And the population is estimated to have reached its lowest point, and I've got a graph in front of me that listeners can't see, little tiny numbers, in the winter 2012 to 2013, there was about 1 hectare of acreage. Now, a hectare is 10,000 square meters. It's a metric measurement, but it is equivalent to 2.5 acres. 2.5 acres is a large city lot in some cities. By the next year, 2013-2014 winter, it was down to 0.67 hectares. We're talking about an acre of monarchs left. And this is down from a high that during, you know, since they've been measuring, of about 19. So we've lost 80 to 90% of the acreage that these monarchs are using in Mexico as an indication of what the population is doing. The following year, it rebounded to about 1 hectare. The good news is that in 2015 and 2016, it was up to 4. And last year, back down to about 3. So this trend, downward trend since the 1990s, is remarkable. And the fact that we're not rebounding quickly is troubling. And that has prompted some action on the part of conservation groups around the nation. And we'll talk about that a little bit, because there is a law in this country called the Endangered Species Act that can be used to protect different species, different organisms, and the habitat that they require. The problem with a migratory species, whether it's a bird or a fish or a marine mammal or an insect, is that you have to protect both ends of the migratory route, where they spend the most time, perhaps, but you also have to protect every link in the chain that is required to get there. So a loss of habitat in a way station area is as critical as preserving habitat on either end. And that for an organism that is traveling 2,000 miles across landscapes that are increasingly developed for neighborhoods, for farming, for highways, the habitat is disappearing, and there's fewer and fewer areas that are available for the monarch to pass through safely. The Oyamel Forest in Mexico are in an area that is poor, and logging and charcoal making are extremely important for income down there, as well as just obtaining fuel. So there is, although the forests are now protected generally by Mexico, there is still illegal logging. Mexico has been very aggressive with help from other nations, including Canada and the U.S., in creating a tourism industry. There are lots of people who want to go down and see monarchs. And by building up an economy based on ecotourism instead of logging, there has been more protection in Mexico. It is not perfect by any means. Climate change is a huge issue. It is happening here in the U.S. It's happening in Mexico. And then if there are more storms in Mexico, in that particular region, bad weather in Mexico can impact the populations as they overwinter. We know that during very cold periods, and they do happen, the monarchs basically get knocked out of the trees by wind and rain, fall to the ground, and most do not survive. So millions and millions die every winter down there, depending on the weather more than anything else. That we have very little control of directly, but it is a climate change question. And that we have some control over, except that under the current administration, maybe not so much. That is part of this bigger picture. How do we, by moderating the impacts on climate change here, where we are a major emitter globally, we have impacts even in the forest of Mexico where these insects are overwintering. So it has to be on our plate. We have impacts far beyond what we recognize in our own backyards. In Canada, there's already a very aggressive effort to plant more milkweeds. The key factor in the migratory pathway, which passes right through the Corn Belt of the U.S., is that agriculture, particularly corn growing, has taken away most of the native prairie, which was the original source of milkweeds, the only plant that monarchs lay their eggs on. And it has been exacerbated by the fact that farmers are now growing primarily genetically modified corn and soybean crops. They have genes in them that allow them to survive spraying with herbicides, specifically Roundup. And these Roundup-ready seeds then are planted in the fields and allows aerial spraying on a regular basis. And the spraying eliminates all the weeds in the field but does not damage the crop. And this is, supposedly the answer to dealing with weeds in your fields, increasing productivity. And I will tell you, some of the research on that suggests that the crop yields are really not significantly higher by using Roundup in the fields, but it's certainly a protocol that's been promoted, marketed heavily in the ag sector, and it's what we're doing nationwide. The downside for the monarch is that most of the monarch larvae that become the adults that migrate to Mexico, that's the generation right now that is growing up in the fields, they come from the Midwest, particularly Iowa, Nebraska, Minnesota, Ohio, Indiana. That section of the Midwest we call the Corn Belt, a little north of us actually, is where about 80% of the monarch larvae that are going to end up in Mexico overwintering start. And now we don't have milkweed there because of the Roundup spraying. And Chip Taylor, Dr. Orly Taylor, who runs Monarch Watch Organization in Lawrence, has done enough research that he thinks the primary problem with the loss of the population of monarchs is agriculture. Now, corn is being grown because it's subsidized. We're trying to get more ethanol produced in order to be, independent energy-wise. The corn is also used for corn syrup, sweeteners, which we use a lot of. And a lot of corn is used for growing meat in this country, whether it's pigs, chickens, or cows. And certainly those are important commodities in Kansas. Don't get me wrong. I understand how much of the economy and our agriculture here is dependent upon that corn growing. But it is being done in a way that impacts the biodiversity of our planet. And I think the question is, it kind of amounts to a fairness question. Does the ag sector get to work strictly on a profit margin that does not take into account the consequences to the rest of the planet. We are depleting the Ogallala aquifer to grow this corn, and by spraying it routinely with Roundup, we're knocking out all of the milk weeds as well as the other weeds which provide host plants, not only for monarchs, but for other insects, knocks out nectar sources for our honeybees, which are also in collapse. And therein lies a huge problem, is shifting the behavior of the agricultural sector in an effort to protect biodiversity. What is important to realize is that if a species is on the brink, there is this law, the Endangered Species Act. And in 2014, a group of not-for-profit organizations and an individual who has actually been studying monarchs for a long time, Lincoln Brower, filed a petition. It's not a lawsuit. It's a petition with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and asked them to consider the biological data, the historical migratory patterns, and so on, and to determine whether this species should be listed. And by listed, we mean is either threatened or endangered. Now, realizing that the monarch species itself is probably not at risk, it's the migratory population, not the entire species, that is at risk because of the migration itself. And it's, you know, it is probably unlikely that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will determine that the species itself is threatened. But with the petition on the table, and Fish and Wildlife Service has determined it is substantial enough, it has enough threat involved that they are going to go through the process of reviewing it. The industry, the ag industry, among others, developers, biologists, are all getting together to see what they can do. Because if the species is listed, and there is this process, we won't know until the end of June 2019 whether the determination will be to list it or not. But to list it means critical habitat has to be designated. And certain practices that we recognize as harming that species would then have to be addressed. And the impacts on the use of our rangeland, which is burned annually in Kansas and sprayed with herbicides, and that's an important part of the habitat for the monarch. The impacts on the corn growing and soybean growing industries would be enormous. And the economic ramifications are driving decision makers throughout the Midwest, 16 different states, to get together. Hey, they have formed something called a joint venture. And here in Kansas, I recently had the opportunity to attend the Monarch Summit. And we had the most amazing group of strange bedfellows I've ever worked with at a conference, all sitting there trying to figure out how to avoid getting this insect on the endangered species list. Because one, I fear as an environmentalist that going that route would mean Congress would ultimately go after the act itself and try to gut it. And I don't think that's where we want to go. Certainly the people in the agricultural sector don't want to see their profits impacted. So they are a stakeholder here. The agencies that are required to protect habitat in these species are there as well. And many of those have political connections, and it gets complicated. So the corn growers were there. The chemical industry representatives are on this body because they have a lot at stake. They sell an enormous amount of Roundup in this country, and that's a profit-making enterprise for the ag industry. The Livestock Association was there. There were Audubon and Native Plant Society people there. I was there representing Sierra Club, actually. All the agency people from the feds on down to county extension agents are there and trying to put our heads together and come up with a plan, a long-term plan, I hope, that will ultimately bring up the number of hectares of butterflies that make it to Mexico every year. And they've actually established a goal, 6 hectares, which is kind of not as good as it was in the 90s, but it's a lot better than it was when it hit bottom at 0.67 hectares. So with a numerical goal in mind, you can do the math and figure out how many pieces of milkweed you have to have on the landscape in the Midwest, and it runs to about 1.3 billion stems of milkweed. And what they even know what kinds of milkweed grow here, grow there. I mean, they are drilling down into this. But it turns out that even if we grow a lot of milkweed in our backyards, if we don't mow the highway right-of-ways, if we plant a lot of milkweed on the pipeline right-of-ways, if we increase the amount of agricultural land we pull out of production and put in reserve, it's called the CREP program, CRP program, we still have to have the agricultural sector on board. We can't do it without them. There's way too much land in the Midwest that is being plowed, put into row crops, and on which we're spraying Roundup and destroying milkweed. So we have to have buy-in from the ag sector. We will never make that goal. I myself will be working on the Urban Outreach Task Force. Our job is to work within the cities, doing education, getting more people to plant milkweeds in the backyard. That is something our listeners could be considering. Milkweeds are available increasingly in nurseries. The one most popular in the gardens is one called butterfly weed. It's got a beautiful orange blossom. It stays put, if you will. It doesn't try to run out through your yard and take over. But it's not really the milkweed that is preferred by monarchs. They will use it, but it's there, and it is the most common one available in the nursery. What I'd recommend is you buy something called swamp milkweed. It's a taller milkweed, has a beautiful pink blossom on it, and is not invasive. It, too, is not the number one choice of the monarch in this area. The monarch in our region likes what's called a common milkweed, which you will not find in the nurseries, likely. But you can go harvest it from a roadside ditch. It's the tallest one with the biggest leaves. The problem is it's only attractive early on. It gets very tall and lanky, gets a lot of aphids and bugs on it, which people aren't real fond of. And it does like to spread in your yard, spreads through underground roots and pops up everywhere in your grass and every flower bed you've got, and makes me happy, might not make you happy. So talk to someone about which are the best choices for your yard. But what we do in our urban communities is not going to be enough. And that's really going to be the difficult battle, is going to be changing what goes on in the ag sector. So we hope that we will see changes in the way that ranch lands are managed. Right now, there is new research coming out of K-State, which has long supported burning of the Flint Hills to remove the woody vegetation to keep the grasslands green for the cattle industry. But more and more research is suggesting that the burning does not have to be annual, that you don't lose, you know, production, beef production, by burning every, say, third year. And what is suggested is what's called patch burn grazing, where ranches are divided up into sectors, and one part of the ranch is burned each year, but not the entire ranch. So the section burned the year before is grazed that year and then begins to regrow some of the plants that monarchs need, which is the milkweed and the nectar plants. By the third year, then you have a more natural prairie environment. It increases the diversity of everything, not just the insect populations that rebound, but the things that eat insects, like the birds. The mammals move back in, the tall grasses, the herps, the snakes, the turtles, I mean, the lizards. But if you're burning annually every acre of the Flint Hills, you are essentially eliminating natural habitat for the benefit of the profit of the rancher. Now, if we can get enough evidence that annual burning is not necessary, that there are other ways to do this and still be profitable, then everyone will benefit. The monarch, especially, because we'll have more milkweeds. And there was one article I read that referred to the monarch as a tent pole species. I'm familiar with the term keystone species, which is a species that supports the whole ecosystem. If you take it out, everything collapses. And I did a program here on the prairie dog last year, And the prairie dog is one of those keystone species. If you remove it, over 100 other species are impacted by that single organism that builds burrows in our prairie. The monarch larvae are important as a food source, although since they eat milkweed, they are not particularly tasty. But the monarch is not really a keystone species. As a tent pole species, think of it as the species that holds up the roof of the tent that all the other animals can live under. So it's a little different image. Without the monarch, protecting the monarch, then we don't protect the prairie habitat. And that prairie habitat has been pointed out over and over again is the most endangered habitat in the U.S. Our tall grass prairies have been farmed, they have been built on, they have been destroyed, and climate change is going to contribute even more to that process. So by protecting the monarch and having this very diverse group of stakeholders engaged, because there is threat to them personally, we may actually see movement here. And we already see, I know, there are a lot of programs out there on our vanishing pollinators. There's more media outreach. But this is an all-hands-on-deck kind of approach to preserving an iconic insect species. And by saving it, we save many other species. So I think it's worth the effort. What's also interesting is by helping to save the monarch, we may in turn be helping to save ourselves, because by using fewer pesticides, herbicides, we have cleaner water, less exposure to what are called biocides. They're life-killing sprays that we put on crops. By preserving more natural habitat, we have more water that infiltrates into the soil and doesn't run off into our streams, carrying nutrients that pollute the streams. It helps to recharge the aquifers, the underground water. It helps keep the soil healthier. By not burning the Flint Hills, every acre of the Flint Hills, every year, we do a great deal to conserve good air quality in the region. In the last couple of years, the annual Flint Hills burning has resulted in very poor air quality in Kansas. In Wichita, they had some days where it was so smoky that you could look up in the sky and see red sun. Normally, the burning blows our smoke from the Flint Hills, the Manhattan area, into Nebraska. And a day after we have major Flint Hill burns in Lincoln and Omaha, they have to issue health alerts and keep the kids in off the playground. So by not burning, all in this one window in April, all of the acreage all at once, we're going to do a lot to preserve our own environment. In addition, the reconstruction restoration of prairie with deep-rooted grasses and forbs allows more carbon to be pulled out of the atmosphere, stored in prairie soils, and this is a huge area for sequestration of carbon. It may help us with our dealing with climate change as well, which is probably the biggest problem we face right now on this planet. So while the monarch is not the keystone, it's the tentpole. By preserving that monarch migration, we may be preserving the Midwest as we know it. So it's an exciting project, and it's not just about running around with a net and catching butterflies and sticking tags on them. It's recognizing the value of this species now as a monarch mystery that we're beginning to solve and doing what humans can do to save them. One of the things that I might talk about here is how do they get to Mexico? I mean, I mentioned there are multiple generations, and so there is no map handed down. Whatever map there is an instinctive map somehow encoded in the cells, the DNA of a monarch butterfly, handed down from generation to generation. And that is a concept that I have difficulty wrapping my own head around. How do you code for this very small, remember we said it was down to almost 1 acre in central Mexico that all of these butterflies go back to? How does that work? You have to have a compass to get there, and that's been one of the areas of really exciting research for those of us who like to get into the weird stuff in biology. We know that birds, like pigeons, have a magnetic compass. They actually have magnetic material in the brain that can orient to north-south, and it helps them find their way. So animals have compasses. We know this. This is old research. We know that even bacteria carry grains of magnetite. It's iron ore that's magnetized that help bacteria orient north-south. And we don't have a clue why they would even want to do that, frankly. But the first thoughts were that monarchs probably had this kind of magnetic compass. Some early experiments suggested no, maybe not, because you can put animals in a reversed field in the lab, and you would expect them to change their orientation. That always did not work. But more recent studies are showing again that there's some element of a magnetic compass involved. But if you have a compass, you also have to be able to know what time of day it is, in a way, because we know that monarchs are using daylight as a cue. Whether they're using the orientation of the sun as it passes across the southern sky, because it moves, rises in the east, sets in the west, and monarchs are, even as far away as Canada and Maine, are coming down to the southwest in this river of insects. Tributaries come in from all different areas, and by the time they reach the Texas central area of Texas, there it is a river of monarchs all headed in the same direction. And we know this. People observe them. They watch the direction they go. They're blown off course by storms. That's true, and they end up in weird places sometimes because of that. But they are strong enough flyers that most of them orient themselves correctly and get down there, even though we don't know how they know where they're going. They're headed in a general southwest direction. So they're using the sun. They have an internal clock of some kind, a circadian clock, that we think we understand even at the molecular level. There's some really fantastic studies coming out that we know how they look at the sun and know what time of day it is. And then they can adjust their course according to what time of day it is, because you want to be to the right of the sun when it comes up. You want to be to the left of the sun when it goes down. And you have to adjust that. And they're going 200-300 miles a day. So they are. It is an incredible journey. And so here we know now that they have some kind of compass. We don't know what they're using for a map. And yet, at the same time, every year, they arrive in Mexico in this tiny little area up in the mountains where they will hang up in these fir trees and manage to survive the winter, if it's not too extreme, by huddling together, sharing body warmth, and becoming dormant. So they're storing energy for their return trip to the Gulf Coast. Now, at the Gulf Coast, then they will lay their eggs. The new generations will start migrating. Here in Kansas, we get usually that first generation that became larvae in Texas will arrive in Kansas in April, usually April, May. And then generation starts here, moves on up towards Canada and the other areas. It's a really fascinating picture. And there's one short story, you know, to tell us that the people in Mexico have known about this a long time. They just didn't share, apparently, didn't feel it was necessary. But the monarch migration has become part of the culture there. Every year, it's usually around Halloween, our time, they're going to leave our area middle of September, end of September, migrating down. Takes about 4 to 6 weeks to get to Mexico. So around October 31st, which I think around November 1st or 2nd is the Day of the Dead in Mexico, these butterflies arrive. And they arrive by the hundreds of millions, fluttering through the little towns, Mexican towns, on their way to these mountainous refuges. And the Day of the Dead is then the day that they arrive. The souls of the previously dead of the villages is presumed to be carried by the monarchs back to mingle with the living. There is celebration. There are flowers put out on the graves, which no doubt the monarchs are using for nectar. And then the monarchs disappear. They move on into the mountains where they roost all winter. And they come back at Easter time. Easter obviously varies according to the calendar, so it's not an exact date. But around Easter, the monarchs reappear, again carrying the souls of the departed, and then they leave again. And so we have an interesting mixture in the culture of the pagan belief that the dead will come back to you and visit you every year at the Day of the Dead. and then the Christian belief of the resurrection in the spring. And it is just one of those kind of stories that gives you a little goosebump feeling that human beings have been looking at this process for maybe thousands of years since their arrival on our continent, and absorbed the phenomenon of the monarch migration into their culture. And now, because of our modern practices and our disregard for maintaining our own diversity on the prairies, that the monarch migration is now very much at risk. So I find that appalling as a biologist because of the incredible intricacies of this process, and culturally as well, that we lose something that has become iconic not only in Mexico but in our cultures as well. So that's the story of the monarch migration. It's a fascinating one. If you had a chance to enjoy the eclipse, congratulations. I hope many did, and respect what is going on our planet, the marvels of nature. But don't forget the monarch migration. It's still out there. Go out and wave in a monarch as it heads south this September and recognize that you can get involved too. There are plenty of places you can go. There's a lot of good information available at the Monarch Joint Venture site, and I'll send you to their website. It's called Monarch Joint Venture, all one word, .org. And they have resources there. If you're a teacher listening, they have a number of handouts you can download and use, resources on milkweed, on everything, how to garden, how to create school gardens, all kinds of stuff. Get involved, because we really do need all hands on deck if we're going to save this migration.
Thank you very much, Elaine. I told you she speaks most eloquently to the subject. And we're going to switch gears now, because I do have on the line, at the top of the show, we talked about the two young women at the Catholic Worker House in Des Moines. And I decided, well, what the heck? Why not try and get them on the line right now? And sure enough, they agreed. So I have Jessica Resnicek and Ruby Montoya on the line from the Catholic Worker House in Des Moines, Iowa. Welcome to the program, folks.
Hey there. Thank you for having us on.
All right. Great. So you guys had some visitors from the FBI the other day.
Lordy, we did. Rude wake-up call pre-dawn with guns in our face and being thrown to the floor the second we opened the front door.
Wow. Wow, that must have been pretty scary, huh? Were you expecting anything like that?
We were anticipating a search, a raid, but nothing of the nature to terrorize the household, no.
Okay, so for our listeners who don't know what this is all about, we have heard Ruby and Jessica on Democracy Now! Maybe a week or two ago, and so I'm taking this from an interview with the Storm Lake Times from the other day. They've admitted to burning pipeline equipment in northern Buena Vista County, and said they burned over $1 million of equipment owned by Precision Pipeline of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, with every ounce of love in their hearts. So that's a hunk of burning love, isn't it?
Yeah. I just recently read that article, and we, in fact, did not say those things.
Oh, really?
No.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm just to let you know that we released our statement. We absolutely did claim responsibility for the burning of machinery on election night of 2016. Ruby and I have no information regarding the amount of damages that were resulted from that. And we don't really concern ourselves with dollar amounts when we're talking about life in general at risk and the earth and the desecration of it. And so those are the terms more that we think in, not dollar signs.
I got you. And so was there a reason you picked election night?
Many people were fascinated with that. And the truth of the matter is that the resistance here in Iowa had just lost another waterway to the Dakota Access Pipeline, and that was the Skunk River. And, you know, the Skunk River has been around longer than any presidential election, around longer than this country, and we felt that that definitely superseded the election, obviously. So that was just a serendipitous occurrence with it lining up with election night.
So is that what motivated you to take such extreme action, or was that what motivated you to pick election, you know, election night? Because that's the timing of that.
I think it happened to be that around a election night time, the resistance here in Iowa was seeing more and more pipes going into the ground and more waterways being bored under and dirt covering the pipe. And we were watching that very closely. Ruby and I were very engaged in all forms of nonviolent resistance, and we're really primarily focused on securing our waterways here in Iowa. And that was what motivated us more than anything. It just happened to be election night and a memorable event because of that.
So what made you guys really dialed it up a notch, basically? And then if I understand the story correctly, no one knew who did it until you folks came out and admitted it. Is that right?
That is correct. That is correct. No one knew anything about it. And to use your term, dial it up a notch, absolutely. We as a nation and as a globe are facing extreme conditions because of the extraction industry, and they continue to dial things up beyond the scale in terms of extraction and proposing more pipelines and all of the things that they're doing to really endanger the sovereignty of every individual. So after exhausting all traditional forms of quote-unquote resistance to this pipeline, including petitions and hunger strikes, public hearings, affidavits, and what have you, we did decide to take a more direct approach and make machinery obsolete by simply taking fire to metal.
Wow. And so, I mean, that's just the physics of that in general, right? I mean, was it a... What was that like? What did it look like? Was it a big fire?
You know, this, it seems very shocking to people, but just the physics of it and, you know, going back to fire and metal, it is very basic. And these are very simple actions that myself and Jessica took, and that other people have taken in the past to stop injustices when our judicial and legislative bodies continue to fail and endanger our way of lives.
And are you surprised you haven't been taken into custody?
No, I don't believe so. As with the judicial system, with everything else that it deals with, it is a long process,
so,
often inadequate.
Right. So you've got a preliminary hearing coming up?
Yeah, that involves what we did after reading our statement in front of the Iowa Utilities Board. We read our statement on a Monday. That preceding Friday, the Iowa Utilities Board again ruled in favor of these private corporations. regardless of the mountains of evidence of the violations, the illegalities of it. So we here as Iowans share the same sentiment that the Iowa Utilities Board does not represent Iowans, but is in fact representing private corporations and their interests and their profits.
I know some of the controversy around the legal resistance to the pipeline was whether it should count as a utility since this wasn't serving the people of Iowa at all. It was just cutting through Iowa, basically, right?
Yeah, it in fact has yet to serve any Americans outside of the very few thousand that actually built the pipeline. You may be aware that it's going to Patoka, Illinois, and from there it will travel to the Gulf to be sold on international waters. So there is no public benefit, only private profit in this.
Yeah, I understand. We've just got a minute left, so I want to make sure that whatever we haven't touched on, maybe you would like to get in that we haven't yet.
Thank you. We appreciate that opportunity. Yeah, I think that I just want folks to know that this was actually a really natural progression for Ruby and I to take these steps after exhausting all conventional methods. Again, when there are no roads left to block and no hearings left to attend and no opportunity to have your voice heard at times like this, I think there are natural next steps. And right now we really want, Ruby and I are really focusing not so much on us, but the issue at hand, and oil continues to flow through this pipeline illegally and immorally. And we refuse to say that we've lost this. We encourage folks to turn vows. We encourage folks to continue to talk about this issue and the fact that, and be, it's a time for self-criticism, like what works and what doesn't. And it's time to let our officials and industry know that we are not going to just admit defeat at this level. We're going to continue to fight for what is right.
Well, ladies, thank you so much for taking time to share with our listeners here in Kansas City. And we appreciate that. And we know you've got a lot going on.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you being understanding.
Okay. All right. Thanks again. And now we'll go to Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. There's more to a lush green plant than meets the eye. Armies of tiny organisms called microbes live on and in leaves, stems, and roots. They help plants absorb nutrients, fight disease, and endure stresses like drought. Now, a biotech startup called Indigo Agriculture is harnessing microbes to help farmers increase crop yields. The company collects microbes from plants around the world and identifies which ones help in drought conditions. For example, some microbes help plants retain water or stimulate root growth. Indigo makes seed coatings using those microbes, which enter the plant's tissue as it grows. Last year, the company launched a microbe-coated cottonseed.
Well, the results were very encouraging. We saw, on average, an 11% increase in yield in West Texas, our target area.
That's Louise Marcus, senior scientist at Indigo. As droughts and extreme heat make growing food harder, he says there's a need to develop crops that can thrive in these conditions. Perhaps microbes, nature's own time-tested tools, can provide a sustainable way to do so. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
As soon as they started drilling for oil, they started building pipelines on the seabed through the forests and across the border lines. As soon as they started laying the pipe, they said, "We'll do this safely. There will never be an accident. We can do this carefully." But the sands shift, the ice melts, disasters are routine. Point out their record of destruction, and they'll say their hands are clean. Point out their woeful deeds, and they'll consult their banker and say it's safer to use a pipeline than an oil tanker. So now they want to see how far their madness it can go. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. The tar sands line the north beneath Alberta's ground. As the price of oil rises, the oil men have found. Now there's profit to be made in a madman's dream by drilling deep beneath earth, blasting it with steam, bulldozing the land, melting what's inside. A record of extinction 1,000 miles wide. But laying waste to the northern plains is evidently not enough. The capitalists need markets where they can sell this toxic stuff. So across the farms and prairies, the oil now must flow. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. Governors oppose it, and every native band. Ranchers don't want it passing through their land. Union leaders have denounced it, as have the rank and file. The president delayed it for just a little while. They say you can't stop progress. I hope that isn't true, cause if we mine the tar sands, if we let the pipeline through, it will be a pipeline to oblivion, a pipeline to the end, a pipeline to a future with nothing round the bend. A pipeline to a future that I hope we'll never know. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. Pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.